Thanks very much for that introduction, and thank you to Finsia for the invitation to come and address you today. We're fortunate to be meeting today in an environment where the worst of the global financial crisis seems to be behind us. If we think back to how things were a year ago, they were very different from the way they are now. World financial markets were reacting to the extraordinary events that had happened the previous month, in September 2008, notably the failure of Lehman Brothers and the string of high-profile failures that occurred in the United States and Europe around the same time. Confidence was collapsing, equity prices around the world were falling sharply, and credit markets around the world were in a state of serious dysfunction. And these events in turn were driving a severe downturn in the global economy, in spending and output. Today we can see with hindsight that the most severe phase of the crisis occurred over roughly a six-month period from September 2008 through to March of this year. It was during that period too that governments around the world were taking some of their most serious and significant actions to stabilise the situation, including things like expanding depositor protection, putting in place various guarantees for wholesale funding, and in some cases by injecting capital directly into their banking systems. And all of that was in addition to the very substantial monetary and fiscal stimulus that was being put in place with the aim of alleviating the general economic downturn. Taking all of those things together, there's no doubt that the scale of both the crisis itself and the set of policy responses to it around the world were the largest in more than a generation. That was the situation a year ago. The good news is that things are now improving, and they have been for some months. The world economy is returning to growth, confidence has picked up, and over the last 6 months or so, financial market conditions around the world have improved significantly on a number of fronts. So given these developments, my theme today is one of cautious optimism about the global situation. We can't yet say that things are back to normal, and we can't rule out further setbacks. But the extreme downside risks that dominated the scene a year ago now seem to have faded. And throughout this period, the Australian banking system has proven to be a lot more robust than some of its counterparts abroad. So I'll take the opportunity to elaborate on those themes today, and along the way I'll try to highlight also some areas of continuing risk that still need to be watched. A good place to start in tracking these events is with global equity markets. And so I'll come to my first slide. Given the central position of the banking sector in the unfolding of the crisis, it's not surprising that when equity markets were falling, bank shares generally fell more sharply than the market as a whole. And you can see that very clearly from this chart. Taking 2007, July of that year, as a starting point, bank shares in the United States, the euro area and the UK all lost about 80% of their value by the time the trough was reached, with the steepest falls being concentrated over the six-month period after the Lehman collapse. But since March this year, there's been a significant turnaround. Bank shares have generally been outperforming the wider market on the way up, and in those same economies that I just mentioned, they've now recovered about a third of their earlier lost ground. One of the other very significant things that is illustrated by these figures is the comparative performance of the banks in Australia. On a number of counts, which I'll come back to later, the Australian banks have proven to be a lot more resilient than some of their counterparts internationally, and one of the ways that that shows up in the various indicators that we can look at has been in the fact that their share prices never fell as severely as they did in other countries. But I'll come back and say more about the Australian banks later on. Another indicator of the general improvement in confidence that we've seen since earlier in the year has been a narrowing of a range of financial risk premiums. And one example of that is the CDS premiums that we're illustrating here. They widened spectacularly late last year, but they've generally now returned to pre-Lehman levels around the world, although they're still high by earlier standards. And the same general pattern can also be seen in a range of other markets. There's been a substantial narrowing of spreads, for example, on bank bonds over government securities in various markets, and also in short-term spreads between banks' wholesale borrowing costs and expected official rates. So all of those markets have been moving in the same direction for several months now towards greater normalisation. To put it another way, what we're seeing is that the extreme risk aversion of late last year has been easing, and it also means that banks' access to wholesale funding markets has been improving. It's important to keep all of that in perspective when I make these observations. These market indicators are still, in some cases, a long way from the position that they were in pre-crisis times, and that's particularly true for borrowing costs at longer maturities. But nonetheless, we should recognise that the improvement over recent months has been significant and encouraging, and it's been broadly based across a range of different economies and different markets. So what's driving the improvement? Well, there are several factors that we can point to that lie behind the recent recovery in sentiment. They include improved prospects for the global economy itself. They include the government policy actions that I mentioned earlier, and also the actions of banks themselves in beginning the task of repairing their balance sheets. In the United States, the stress tests that were done earlier this year prompted significant capital raisings by some of the major banks, and by making the potential capital costs clearer, the exercise seems to have contributed to the broader rebuilding of confidence. Another important contributor to confidence has been a recovery in bank profitability. Losses of the major global banks generally peaked in the second half of 2008. In the United States, for example, federally insured banks collectively lost around $12 billion last year, but in 2009 to date, they've recovered to a position of aggregate profit. And broadly similar profit recoveries have been seen at the aggregate level in the UK and the euro area. Although, of course, when we talk about these aggregate numbers, we do have to recognise that there's significant variation at the level of individual banks. Now, while all of this is encouraging from a financial stability viewpoint, there are still challenges ahead. One reason for the sharp spike in losses that we see from this chart here and the subsequent rebound in profitability this year has been the one-off nature of securities write-downs, which were concentrated in the second half of last year. And you see that from this next chart. Crisis-related securities losses by the largest international banks are estimated to have peaked at around $200 billion in the second half of 2008. And in the first half of this year, that figure was down to about $60 billion. So that factor on its own represents a big contribution to the turnaround in profit performance to date, and we need to recognise that that is actually a short-term influence. The factor that's going to take longer to play out will be the evolution of losses in banks' on-balance sheet lending. Over the past 2 years, loan loss provisions by banks in the US and Europe have increased substantially, although they were coming off a low level. Based on data for a group of the largest banks in those economies, loan losses were up by 70% in the first half of 2009 from their levels a year earlier. In the case of the major US banks, they were running at around 4.5% of the aggregate loan book. And we're illustrating some further detail on the US banks' loan losses in this next slide. It's difficult to say at this stage how quickly these loan losses might start to taper off. In the United States, loan performance up to this point has been deteriorating across all the main categories of lending. Charge-off rates have been particularly high for consumer debt, where loan quality has been affected by a combination of poor lending practices and rising unemployment. And it's possible that losses in this area will rise further. But perhaps the more important area to watch, both in the US and elsewhere, will be exposures to commercial real estate. Commercial property prices have fallen significantly in many countries, and loans to this sector are generally expected to be amongst the worst performing. And past experience suggests that the dynamics in this sector may take a while yet to unfold. Having made that point of caution, however, it's important to recognise that real progress has been made in strengthening banks' balance sheets since the crisis broke out. The profit recovery has assisted with this, but banks have also been taking active steps to strengthen their balance sheets by selling non-core assets and by raising new capital, as well as by, in a number of cases, benefiting from public capital injections. Here's a look at the capital raisings over the last 3 years for the major banks in the US, the UK and the euro area. In total, the largest banks in the US and Europe, taking all of that together, they've raised nearly $500 billion of new capital since the fourth quarter of last year. A lot of that came initially from public sources, but in a number of cases, that's now been replaced by private investment. Another encouraging development internationally has been improved access to non-guaranteed wholesale funding. As I said earlier, risk spreads on a range of credit instruments have been narrowing significantly from last year's peaks. At the short end of the curve, spreads on three-month wholesale funding relative to expected official rates have more than fully reversed their post-Lehman spikes. It's true that they're still higher than they were at pre-crisis levels, but we shouldn't be regarding those levels as permanent norms. At the long end of the yield curve, the contraction in spreads has been less pronounced, but it's nonetheless helping to make unguaranteed issuance more attractive. In conjunction with some other factors that have also been operating, this has contributed to reduced reliance on guaranteed debt by banks around the world. If we look just at US banks, for example, looking at US banks, the bulk of their issuance over the last few months, virtually all of it, has now been unguaranteed. Attention in many countries is now turning to how to exit from these emergency support arrangements. The US government has confirmed that its wholesale guarantee for bank debt will expire at the end of this month. And for other countries, expiry dates have also been set. The most common expiry dates at the end of 2009, although for some countries it is later than that. Before I turn to Australia, one final point to make about international conditions is that the process of deleveraging and balance sheet repair also has its counterparts in private non-financial sectors. Both the household and business sectors in the major economies have been reducing their levels of debt, and businesses around the world have substantially increased their raisings of equity. For the time being, this is an environment where the private sector's demand for credit in the major economies could remain quite weak, but it's part of the process of adjustment that will help to promote sustainable recovery. Let me now turn to the domestic scene. Overall, the Australian banking system has remained resilient throughout the crisis period. One very clear point of contrast to the situation elsewhere in the world is that the Australian banking sector has remained profitable. And I'm illustrating that here by reference to the major Australian banks. For the major banks, the rate of return on equity has so far fallen only modestly. In the latest half year, it dipped to around 13.5%, which is lower than it's been for a few years, but still a very strong performance in the circumstances. There has been some diversity of performance across the different categories of domestic banks. The smaller banks, including the regionals, have reported a sharper decline in profitability, partly because their loan losses have increased faster. And they were also less successful than the major banks in maintaining the growth of their net
interest earnings. Nonetheless, they have to date remained in profitable overall, which is a marked contrast to the countries that I spoke about earlier. So the Australian banks have done a lot better than their counterparts overseas. What explains that? Well, an important general point is that the performance of the financial sector is closely interrelated with the performance of the economy itself. Australia came into the crisis period in better shape than most and with more scope than most to make timely macroeconomic policy responses. Partly as a result of that, the overall slowdown in the economy has been much milder than occurred elsewhere. We've also benefited from our close linkage with the Asian region, where financial sectors were less affected by the crisis and economic conditions have bounced back reasonably quickly. In fact, what's commonly referred to as a global financial crisis has been mainly a crisis in the United States and Europe. That said, there have also been some important aspects of the Australian financial system itself that have contributed to domestic resilience. One of those is that the Australian banks had only very limited exposure to the types of securities that led to major losses abroad, US mortgage-backed securities, CDOs and the like. The Australian banks were making good profits on their domestic operations, and in a period where banks in some other countries were building up large portfolios of high-risk securities, the Australian banks tended to focus their operations on domestic lending. Another factor is that the quality of banks' on-balance sheet loans didn't deteriorate to anywhere near the same extent as occurred in the United States and Europe. The difference here is particularly striking for the housing loan portfolio, which I'm illustrating in this next chart. In Australia, despite a gradual increase over the next few years, banks' non-performing housing loans are still only a bit over half of 1% of the amounts outstanding. In the UK and Spain, that ratio is between 2 and 3%, and in the United States, it's approaching 6%. Those differences tell us something about the deterioration in lending standards that occurred elsewhere, but they also testify to the generally sound practices that have continued to prevail in the Australian housing market over recent years. And this in turn has made a very important contribution to the bank's overall balance sheet quality, given that housing loans comprise about 60% of their aggregate loan book. There has, however, been a more significant deterioration in loan quality in the business portfolio. Impairments on commercial property loans have been increasing over the past couple of years, and business loan losses have generally picked up as the economy slowed. This is going to remain an area to watch in the period ahead. Nevertheless, banks' aggregate impairment rates are still low in comparison to other countries, and they're only a fraction of the level that they reached in the early 1990s. The banks are well capitalised, as we can see here. They're well capitalised, and they've strengthened their balance sheets further over the past year with significant additional capital raisings. So with asset quality generally remaining resilient, the main effect of the global crisis on Australian banks has been through the effect on funding conditions. As was happening elsewhere in the world, wholesale funding became both more expensive to obtain relative to the policy rate and also harder to get. At the height of the crisis, some markets were effectively closed altogether. The introduction of the guarantee scheme late last year played an important role in ensuring continued access to wholesale funding for the Australian banking system, and in that way it enabled the system to continue lending through the most intense phase of the crisis. But for some months now, the strains in global markets that gave rise to these difficult conditions have been gradually easing. Australian banks have benefited from the general narrowing in risk spreads that I talked about earlier and the increased tolerance for risk in global financial markets. Short-term wholesale spreads for Australian banks have contracted quite markedly, and at longer terms, the availability and cost of unguaranteed funding have improved. As a result, banks have been able to make greater use of the unguaranteed market. The proportion of funds that banks have been raising through their unguaranteed issuance in the bond market has risen from next to nothing at the end of last year to around 75% in the latest month. Another consequence of the recovery in risk appetite is that spreads in the Australian mortgage-backed securities market have narrowed. Again, they're still high by earlier standards, but they've narrowed sufficiently to support some renewed issuance to private investors over the last couple of months. All of these are encouraging signs, and certainly they represent a significant improvement on conditions earlier in the year. Let me just conclude with a few brief remarks to sum up. As I said at the outset, my theme today has been one of cautious optimism. The past year has been an extremely challenging time, but Australia's financial system, like the economy itself, has come through it in better shape than most. Globally, we can't yet say that conditions have returned to normal. Risk pricing in a number of areas is still high, and there are still some areas of significant risk on financial sector balance sheets. But the extreme dislocation of a year ago has passed. Market conditions have been on an improving trend for several months, and the risks to the world financial system now seem much more evenly balanced than they were. Thanks very much for listening.
Governor, thank you very, very much. Could I begin the questions by asking you, the work which FINSE has recently completed with Access Economics on navigating reform suggests that systemic risk was far more pervasive than we had previously believed it could be. Do you think that there are implications for regulation going forward and for central banks around the world in their role as lenders of last resort, that systemic risk can arise not just in the banking system but also in the markets, and that increasingly we saw central banks becoming lenders of last resorts not just to banking but to the markets? So is that a feature that's likely to continue in the future, or is this just a once-off anomaly?
Well, there are a lot of lessons to be drawn from the crisis. One of them was the importance of liquidity. And when we think about this, we should remember that the reason we have central banks in the first place, or one of the very important reasons and one of the initial rationales for central banking as part of the system was as a provider of liquidity in an emergency for commercial banks. That is a feature of the banking system. Commercial banking relies on maturity transformation and it's fundamentally a business of financial intermediation, and that means that occasionally in conditions of extreme panic commercial banks will find themselves in a position where they need to have access to the central bank to ensure that that solvent institutions can continue to operate. So we saw that tested to the extreme in the crisis, and I think what we saw there was that our system actually came through it in very good shape. The Reserve Bank itself took various steps to expand the range of collateral that was available to the commercial banks to bring in for liquidity. I think those measures served us well. But I think that regulators around the world, and including in Australia, are still in the process of studying the lessons from the crisis. There are a lot of things to be learned, and there's a major effort going on now to review capital standards and liquidity standards for the banking system to see how we can strengthen the arrangements we already have. So that we hope they can work even better next time. But I think really the main lesson within Australia is that our system was severely tested. We think what just happened was a once-in-a-generation event, the system came through it.
Richard Posner has recently suggested that the distinction between successful regulation and regulators and regulatory regimes is not actually the regulation itself, but rather the willingness and the freedom of the institutions to actually supervise. Do you think that what we've seen to date holds that out in that terms of you know, there's calls for more and more regulation, but it is in fact maybe there's an argument for greater supervision rather than additional regulation? Or is that distinction too fine a distinction?
No, I think that's a very important point. I think there's a natural tendency when we look back for lessons from the crisis to think, how could the rules have been different to make a crisis less likely to occur? And you can understand why people want to ask that question, and it does make sense to go back and look at that. And that's why regulators are saying, well, we need tougher capital rules and we need tougher liquidity standards to make crises less likely to occur. But we shouldn't forget the element of human decision-making in all of this. Banks have to make sensible decisions about the management of their own business, and it's the job of supervisors to ensure that the standards that we have are sensibly applied to the commercial banks. And I think there is a bit of a danger, and I'm not referring in any way to Australia here, because I think in Australia we've been very well served by our supervisory arrangements, but I think that in some other countries there is a tendency to focus on rulemaking, and that there could be more benefit from focusing as well on how the rules are applied and the quality of supervision. So I think that is a very important point that you've raised.
Thank you. Anisha Srinivasan from Financial Education Professionals. Going back to your comments on the yield curve and the risk premiums that you mentioned, the narrowing at the short end, you mentioned we're still not back to the levels prior to the onset of Lehman. With the benefit of hindsight, are we ever realistically going to get back to those levels in the near term? And secondly, the long end, what sort of factors do you think we need to see a material narrowing at the long end?
Okay, I think at the short end, it's unrealistic to think we're going to get back to where we were pre-crisis. The pre-crisis position was that was the period where the central narrative of the global financial system was the search for yield. Everybody was looking for ways to pick up yield. There was a huge appetite for risk, and the risk premiums built into wholesale borrowing costs at the short end became extremely narrow to an extent that I think was unrealistic. But nonetheless, it's encouraging that there has been a substantial narrowing at that end over the last 6 months or so. At the longer end, I think what we're really seeing is it's just the hangover of the blowout in risk aversion that was really at the heart of this whole crisis. And risk aversion tended to occur disproportionately at the long end. Markets were willing to commit funds for short periods, but risk aversion became increasingly severe for longer-term commitments, and so that's why long-end yields blew out more. They've started to correct now, but they haven't done so to nearly the same extent that's happened at the short end. But I think what we'll see is that as conditions normalise and people get more comfortable with seeing that the various financial stresses are being dealt with and that balance sheets are being repaired, we will see those things gradually narrowing. But again, I think the days of extremely narrow risk pricing that we saw in the lead-up to the crisis are not going to return soon, and it's unrealistic to expect that.
Jeff Weinstock, The Financial Review. I just wanted to pick up, you were talking about the way the system worked well in providing liquidity at the end of last year, and how the central bank, or this Reserve Bank, performed its role as the lender of last resort and gave liquidity to the banking system. There's a whole bunch of... And then you also said that we're now having tougher rules on liquidity. I just wonder, given the costs that banks will face in holding more liquid assets, why do we need to have tougher rules on liquidity if the system worked well last time? And if you're still there as the lender of last resort, why do we need to change anything?
Well, the answer to that, I think, is the system worked well in an emergency, and you have to have a backup that will work in an emergency if you've got solvent banks but a severe global liquidity panic. That's what we had, and the system works, but you don't want to normalise those sort of arrangements. There needs to be, in normal times, market discipline on the banks, because if you don't have that, then you're really steering yourself towards a system where, even in the long run, it's the central bank that is the main assessor of credit risk out in the financial system. We don't want that to be the case. We want there to be, in normal times, market discipline on the banks, and that means that they have to be able to manage their own liquidity needs in normal times, and to have some internal backup when times start to get tough. You don't want to declare a state of emergency immediately as soon as there's any hint of trouble. You want to have a system that has what I call defence in depth when there are times of trouble, so that banks have a capacity to manage their own way out of adverse circumstances in the first instance, and the sort of emergency support that I was talking about earlier, that really is, it's emergency backup and shouldn't be thought of as being there for normal times.